Hello and welcome to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host for the next half hour, Jimmy Bernasconi, and this week's episode is entitled Russia. So we're tackling a pretty big topic this week and next week. If you didn't hear me mention there, this is the episode. This week's episode is entitled Russia Part 1 of 2, I should say. This is a huge topic. So I think we are going to try and break it down over 2 weeks. That might be a Sacred Cinema first. But basically, I saw this new film this week called Compromat. Saw an advanced screening at PAL. So thank you very much, PAL Cinemas, for setting that up. And I thought it was quite interesting. But it's also something I've been meaning to talk about all year on the show, which is obviously we've got the war in Ukraine and everything. And I think people have been quite curious and intrigued about, you know, where Russia's head is at and, you know, why they're doing what they're doing. It's important to sort of understand the enemy, as it were. But also just it's important when it comes to big global events to understand the full context of what's going on. And is there a better way to do that than through cinema? I mean, the news is good because it gives you the facts, or at least it tries to, depending on what you're watching. But when we look at art gives us, you know, a much more emotive depiction of where a culture, where its heart and where its head is at, and what it's been through, and what are some of the vestiges that still haunt that population. And it sort of gives us a whole new way of being informed about why someone or a place might do a certain thing. And also, I think this week's episode and next week's will tie on really well from last week's episode on rules and dominions. I don't think that's any coincidence, by the way. I mean, we've said this a couple of times on the show, you know, where we do a newly released film and it actually just ties in with what we're already talking about. Well, of course it does, because, you know, our heads are in a certain place. All of our heads are sort of in the same hive, so to speak. And if a director comes out with a new film, it's most likely going to be about something that we're interested in anyway. So I don't think that really is a coincidence. It's sort of like a collective unconscious kind of thing going on. But as I mentioned, if we're looking at sort of the history of a country, and that's sort of what we're doing, by the way, we're going to start with Compromat, which is sort of like modern Russia, and then we're going to go all the way back to the 15th century and move forward over the next 2 weeks and try and, in moving forward through, you know, in a chronological order, try and answer some of the questions that we start off with today by going through Compromat, try and get to the end and see if we can provide some insights, some more insights after doing that. But this is obviously, it's a massive history. We can't cover everything. There's just so much to it, and it is a huge country with a massive history. And, you know, there's only so much that we can get out of the films themselves. So I'm conscious I'm going to be missing things in the history of Russia, missing things in the films themselves, because the films are gargantuan. Some of the ones we're going to talk about are classic, canonical, called Behemoth. So I apologize in advance for only sort of whipping through them. But given sort of how profound all this stuff is, let's get started now with the films. The first one is going to be Jerome Salle's film from this year, Compromat. We're then going to move on to Andrei Rublev by Andrei Tarkovsky, a massive movie. Then we're going to finish off with Ivan the Terrible Parts 1 and 2, directed by, of course, Sergei Eisenstein, part one coming out in 1944 and the second one coming out in 1958. Tarkovsky and Sergei Eisenstein are going to be the two big players over the next 2 weeks. These are going to be the focus directors, masters. And as I mentioned a second ago, you know, we're not going to be able to even, we're going to hardly even scratch the surface of all these films, but we're going to try our best to sort of hit the main points. But without any further delay, then let's get started now with Jerome Salle's film from this year, Compromat. So if you haven't seen this one yet, and I imagine you may not have because it hasn't come out yet in Australia at least, the main character is a guy from Alliance Française, and he's working in Russia. And it's really important, I think, that he works for Alliance Française, because if you're not sure what that is, we have them here in Australia. It's like these organizations that go to other countries to like promote French culture and the French language and that sort of thing. And I think it's particularly important that it's a French guy in a Russian country, particularly because of the status quo in terms of what Russia is doing culturally and what the Russian government wants in terms of what its people are. And I mean, the idea, the concept of Russia's cultural identity is kind of what we're talking about throughout the next 2 weeks, and it's going to be so central to all the films we're going to be talking about. And it's significant as well that he's from France as well, because if you compare sort of French culture and Russian culture, you know, the French culture is very sort of cosmopolitan and I suppose bohemian in a sense and very sort of progressive, you know, if you think about all the things that have come out of France over the years and Russia sort of has this macho kind of cold, wintry, stoic mentality. It's interesting, so I suppose the Russian government kind of sees this promotion of French values as sort of an imposition or sort of like a cultural invasion. And so you have obviously there's a very obvious theme of sort of like xenophobia in this film, but some of the examples of the things that sort of trigger the Russian government are this guy, I don't know, I can't remember if he sets up this concert or he's just attending it, but there's like this interpretive dance concert and all these Russian guys get up and leave because the two dancers start kissing each other and they're both men, and the guy from our protagonist from Arnold Schwarzenegger just kind of sitting there be like, what is the problem, it's just two boys kissing each other, it's no big deal, you know. And then there's also like a photo that goes out, he's like housekeeper takes of him dressed up in a tutu playing with his daughter, and like and this is obviously very relevant as well, because I mean last week or 2 weeks ago the Russian government literally passed laws about sort of like the LGBT movement and sort of, you know, it's pretty wide, you know, widely known that they're fairly cynical, that sort of thing over there. So you like what's key to this film is the sort of diametric opposition between, let's call it in quotation marks, the imposition of Western French values on sort of that kind of macho, leave us alone, Russian culture. So that's one half of the film that is relevant, at least that brings up one of the key questions we're going to be trying to answer this next couple of weeks, which is what is Russia defending? What's this specific cultural identity? Why is it so valuable to them? Why are they so protective of this identity that they have, that they're defending so closely? And when we're seeing that in the current war, where they're claiming that this gradual supposed invasion or this gradual imposition of Western values into Russia, and you know, Russia seeing itself not as a Western nation, to them is something that has triggered this massive response, and they think is extremely profound and needs to be taken very seriously. Whereas us in the West are kind of like, what are you talking about? We're not trying to invade you. We're not trying to change your culture. But we're tapping into this sort of this insecurity that Russia kind of has. The other half of the film I want to talk about, and it leads on from that, is the fact that this film is a fugitive film. And so it's an interesting, from a symbolic, on a symbolic level, like a metaphorical level, it's interesting that this film is Russia is the one that's invading Ukraine right now. And I know this film was made before the invasion of Ukraine, but you know, Russia is the one that is invading. Russia is the one that is sort of asserting its own sovereignty. Interesting, this is a film about a Frenchman escaping the grasp that Russia has over him. So it's an interesting sort of subversion of, I suppose, the movements or the orientation of what's happening between Russia and the West. You could imagine this being a film where it's more about a guy that's kind of near the border of Russia, and Russia kind of like quickly eats him up and disposes of him. But it's about a guy that's already in Russia and trying to escape. But I think it does still resonate with us, because despite there is this sort of isolationism that's going on, and Russia trying to maintain its own sovereignty and maintain its own specific cultural identity, it does sort of feel, from watching the news every day, that we are trying to escape. We are sort of escapists of this threat or the scariness of what Russia dares to assert. I don't want to say impose, but what it dares to assert about itself. We do kind of feel like we need to be escapists. And in talking about escapism, I think it makes sense now to move on to our next film. But you know, in talking about this idea of, you know, Russia asserting this specific cultural identity, us trying to figure out why that is, and this sort of this sense of escapism, and how can we sort of either escape that grasp or at least somehow better understand why we might be feeling that way about Russia, I think it makes sense to move on to our next film. Now, but before we do, just remind you are listening to 2XX FM 98.3 People Powered Radio. I'm your host for the remainder of this half-hour slot, Jimmy Bernasconi. Be sure to stay tuned to our wonderful radio station to listen to more quality radio content here on 2XX, or jump onto our website to listen there. Consider subscribing to the station while you're there, or sponsoring the show, or any of 2XX's programs while you're there. But moving on now to a big boy. This is Andrei Rublev. from 1966, directed by Andrei Tarkovsky. A very, very famous film. If you're not familiar with it, I mean, I think it's very hard to describe what this film actually is about because it is about so much stuff. I like the very succinct description, though, on the IMDb page for this film, which is basically that it accounts the lifetimes and afflictions of famous Russian iconographer Andrei Rublev. But before we tackle the film itself, I think it's really important, actually. We've talked about Tarkovsky before on the show many, many months ago when we did Stalker, but I think it's really important to acknowledge the fact that he was a very deeply religious Orthodox Christian. And, I mean, the original title of this film was The Passion, according to Andrei. So it is a very religious film, and definitely in terms of its symbolism and its characterization and the obvious links to Jesus Christ. And, I mean, that's no surprise. That's kind of like an obvious thing when you go in and watch this film. But it equally serves as kind of like a meditation on the various stations of an artist. And I guess in a really simplistic way, a big part of what Tarkovsky does with this film is he sort of equates Rublev to Christ, or equating sort of the idyllic Russian artist to Christ. And obviously, as a devout Christian, he sees great value in that and feels he ought to promote, in his adherence to Christ, promote Christian values as best he can. You know, this is transcendental cinema at its best. You know, this is about serving a greater purpose through artistry. So in one sense, you know, Andrei Rublev himself was an iconographer in relation to Christ. In this film specifically, but I guess in another Tarkovsky films, Tarkovsky is an iconographer in his own right, in a way. So when we talk about iconography, it's the idea of sort of promoting and adhering to this greater being, you know, Christ. It's almost like Tarkovsky, in doing that, is adhering to Christ via promoting the Christ-like figure that was Andrei Rublev. So he is simultaneously... And in doing that, he's simultaneously sort of adhering to his sort of Christian values and telling this very beautifully profound philosophical story. But at the same time, he's also sort of making a comment on or exploring Russia's cultural identity. And who better else to do that through than Andrei Rublev, who is so key to Russia's artistic history. But you know, I mean, there's a lot of profound ways of describing this film. It being this promotion, that sort of thing. I suppose another way of promotion of Christian / this amorphous of Christian Russian cultural icons. I suppose another way of thinking about it is sort of what are the sort of questions that this film might address, or is there a way that this film can serve us in today's conversation around Russia's own cultural identity? I suppose this film kind of asks this question, or tries to address the question of sort of what would the obstacles be for someone who is trying to be an idyllic cultural leader, specifically in the context of Russia. When you get to this film, the end of this film, you could probably feel like you've really explored the question of what is sort of the idyllic Russian cultural leader. And we've talked about cultural leadership a lot on this film, and it's different to sort of political power or economic power. Someone who is a cultural leader is someone who is sort of influencing the world through the artistic expressions that they create and that they provide to the world. People who inspire, people who influence, whether they're audiences realize it or not. And Tarkovsky does all this. We're actually going to get into the nitty-gritty of the film by sort of, there's all these different chapters in the film. And you could sort of describe them, I suppose, as like stations of Rublev's journey as this sort of quasi-Christ-like artistic figure. I mean, if you are a creative person in the world out there, or even if you're just someone that needs inspiration, so in other words, a human being, this film is like a Bible. Like, it's so beautiful, and just like an emotional dictionary. Like this, you go through the entire roller coaster ride of what it means to not just be human, I mean, but to be someone that has an affliction, where you want to go into the world and make it something and serve something that is greater than yourself. You want to create and change and influence the world in monumental ways, despite the fact that you have these gigantic obstacles, these like sickening and disgusting obstacles in front of you. But I think we should sort of very briefly go through the actual stations that Rublev it comes up against it in the film. I mean, there's a prologue as well, which is about, which is just sort of a quick little short film, I suppose, at the start of the film, of this dude that gets on this hot air balloon. And there's this angry mob that's kind of trying to stop him from, you know, flying, essentially. So there's a very obvious their connection to, you know, there's a bit of a Fellini thing going on here at the start of this film. But basically, a guy going up in a hot air balloon and flying away, which is obviously, you know, a very obvious depiction of sort of liberation, being, you know, unbridled and being able to, you know, be free in the world. But then inevitably, you know, the hot air balloon comes crashing down. So this is sort of this, we've got this upward and then downward contour at the very beginning of the film, about the idea of, you know, the struggle for liberation. People want to hold you back, and then, you know, despite the ecstasy one feels in that space, eventually we do come crashing down. We eventually do have these inevitable obstacles. But the first section that actually has Rublev and his little posse in it is the Skomorok part. And Skomorok is kind of like a Russian jester, at least in medieval times. And I think that little section is sort of, you know, he gets captured by these horsemen, and it's sort of about the suppression of defiant voices. And then there's this other section that's about Theophanes the Greek, and he's this sort of renowned artist who picks Rublev over his other artist friend Kirill. And so that's kind of like an exploration of the competition within artistry, the competition within sort of cultural iconographers, cultural leaders, artists, you know, that sort of thing. And then they have the passion section, which is a very clear reference to sort of a Russian Christ-like figure. And I suppose you could say that's kind of like talking about the impetus for art and the reason for art, and sort of the I guess maybe some sort of like the obligations of the artist, and sort of a nice little summary of maybe the film itself. And then you have the next bit after that is like the festivity bit, and I suppose that's a bit about temptation, because there's this whole pagan thing going on there. And then there's the last judgment bit, which is, I suppose you could say that this bit is sort of maybe a little bit about like the artistic dilemma, about, you know, giving yourself the space to be influenced, so to seek inspiration and to be influenced by the world outside you without sort of being too closed off. But then also that, you know, the dilemma there of you actually need to work, and you actually need to put the pen to paper. You can't just be a perfectionist. And then after that, you know, not coincidentally, is the raid scene, which is kind of like the penalty for kind of that procrastination in not sort of putting pen to paper soon enough, and people and their lives being utterly and disgustingly destroyed because, you know, a clear cultural vision hasn't yet been, you know, that's stable and reliable hasn't been implemented. And then you have the silence bit, which is like the repentance bit of the film. And then finally you have the bell sequence, which has kind of got this interesting kind of like fake it till you make it. How does an artist truly find, you know, eternal inspiration in the art? So that's a very quick and dirty, disgusting summary of a film that is maybe way too profound to put to words. But the reason I want to sort of go through that rapidly and at least touch on all of those little chapters is, I suppose, to say that one clear sort of insight that we can draw from this film is that finding one's cultural voice, be it a person, an artist, or a country itself, or a political entity, finding one's cultural identity is extremely difficult. It's a turbulent journey. It's one that will take every single thing out from you, and it'll make you want to end it all. This guy goes through hell on earth throughout this film, and witnesses that happening in trying to bring together a Russia that at this point in history, during the 14th century, before Ivan the Terrible, who is an extremely important figure in Russian history, trying to pull all these things together. You know, it's an extremely difficult thing to do, both on the personal and the political level. Basically, you got to think about it like this. Like, think of a constitution of a country, not to say that, you know, that Russia is a constitutional country at this point in history, or that's what it's striving to be. But if you think about the idea of constituting, you know, for a country, trying, it's like, imagine having a blank canvas, this blank slate, and trying to put to words or put to pictures an idyllic version of that country that everyone can get behind, to the extent that it's not going to lead to constant revolution and rebellion, but is also going to be, you know, reliable and actually lead to progress and develop that society. That's kind of what Russia is doing in the 15th century. It is this mishmash of all these different conflicting perspectives and parties and interested groups, and it's warish and bloody and gross. And we see this theme of conflicting perspectives, which is something we've talked about last week as well. The idea that power is never held in one person's hands. Especially in this point in Russia's history, it's being pushed and pulled between various people, both internally within groups that have some sense of solidarity, and also obviously there's external threats as well. But internally, I think one of the interesting things, particularly in terms of Rublev and his relationship with Kirill, is this internal competition between artists themselves. When people are striving to when people are striving to create beautiful art, when they are striving to serve God or serve this transcendent purpose of an ultimate creator, they differ in their abilities, and they differ in their perspectives, and that creates tension and pulls apart what would otherwise be really important, strongly held communities that are required for the greater sense of things. But also within just the religious world of Russia at this time, obviously religion plays a massive part in medieval Russia, but it's kind of unclear like which parties are, who's more religious and who isn't. You've got this Grand Duke character that he goes in with, and he forms this alliance, allegiance with the Tatars, and then then there's also this flashback of him being in a church service with his brother, who is his enemy. We have another internal conflict there, but then we know that he has a religious connection there. Well, not the Grand Duke himself, but the brother. Not to get into the semantics of it, we see that there's a religious tie constantly, a lot of the characters have. But then you've got the Tatars that he is serving with. They don't even know anything about Christianity, and has to explain it to them. And so there's a clear sort of, again, a severance within them in a way as well. But then also, speaking of the Tatars, they are an external threat, or at least they were for a time, but now they're not. And then you also have the Boyars, who are a massive part of Russia's history around this time, who are this elite ruling, landowning, ruling class, and these princes and grand dukes who run the show. People bow down to them, civilians bow down to them, but they secretly hate them. And we talk about that. The Skomorok figure at the start of the film, that's who he's making fun of, who then drags him out on a horse, and he's sort of left, banished off into some nether region place. So when we get to the end of a film like Andrei Rublev, we do ask this question: how did Russia overcome this? Right, this absolutely turbulent history. And at this point of today's conversation, I think it makes sense to move on to Ivan the Terrible Parts 1 and Part 2, because Ivan the Terrible was the first Tsar of all of Russia. And so his role in unifying Russia and what he did to sort of overcome all this turbulence, I hate to keep saying that word, but it is sort of the perfect word for Russia's history during this time, the boyars and all this sort of thing, his role is super important, and hence why Stalin was sort of supportive of at least part one of this film, because it was a reminder to the Russian people that a single ruler can be, or can, sort of be this invaluable force to create a sense of cultural solidarity and cultural direction. So in talking about this film, these two films, I want to sort of separate them and sort of distinguish why they're, distinguish them from one another, and talk about sort of how they best depict how Ivan was able to sort of create and maintain what we now can consider from the benefit of hindsight, a unified or somewhat consistent sense of a Russian identity, or a coherent sense of a Russian identity. So for part one, I think a subtitle for part one could be sort of how Ivan reigned in the elites. So when we start off with this film, we get his coronation, the scene of his coronation, and there's Eisenstein, obviously Soviet filmmaker. There's a massive emphasis on how rich and how monarchical and how regal this coronation was, and how when he was coronated, there's literally coins being poured over his head onto the floor. So at this point in the film, we have this very literal depiction of the pouring of riches being something that the Russian elite is able to do and embraces. And sort of, from a Soviet point of view, many, many years in history, we see this to be a very evil thing, and saying that, isn't very fair to all the commoners and things like that. And that was one of the things that, a guy like Stalin really liked about Ivan the Terrible, which he was very anti this ruling class, anti the boyars. But I suppose, that's not enough to sort of talk about how he was able to resist that sort of thing. Because it's one thing to be sort of against it and to say, oh, that's not really, you know, very good that you guys have all this money and you sort of very, you know, very, you just throw it around all the place while there's people starving and things like that. The film also addresses sort of how he does that. And I suppose in a very simplistic way, the way he sort of reigns in the elites is this firm hand of power. And there's so many instances and so many ways that Eisenstein sort of creates this character who has this firm hand of power. I mean, the obvious one is just in the cinematography and also just sort of the costuming and the makeup that Ivan's face has this sort of jagged downward eyebrow, this beautiful beard coming out of his chin. He looks like this sort of like supernatural dragon-like figure, and with all the shadows and the way that the lighting is done in this film, it is absolutely breathtaking the entire way through. But there's also like just so many other little choices that Eisenstein makes to create this. There's a bit at the start where he when he's getting coronated, his wife sort of like swoons at him when he's like standing there like so majestically. And like I gotta say, like with the Prokofiev soundtrack playing and you're watching this guy sort of walk around, he is this sort of like Sigma male archetype guy. You kind of do sort of like get a bit fired up watching him, realizing like this guy is like, you know, the archetypal form of like absolute power in a way. But there's also, you know, these great bits of dialogue where he talks about, you know, a state without reins is like a horse without a bridle. And also sort of when his wife is on her deathbed at one point, she's sort of like, this is the wife that was swooning at her before. She sort of looks him in the eyes and tells him, you know, be firm. And he sort of like looks back and he's like, yes. So in part one, we have this concept of a firm hand of power, which will be very important to Russia's history and Russia and the reign of other Russian leaders and rulers throughout the rest of history. In part two, We sort of develop that idea a bit further. How does the firm hand of power maintain itself, I suppose, throughout history, particularly when you have all of these conflicting interest groups? You've got the boyars, and you know, the second one is all about how he gets rid of the boyars. And I think the second one, the part two of this film, I guess you could, the subtitle I would give it is sort of, you know, the illusion of isolation that Ivan had. So throughout the film, he talks about how lonely he is. But of course, we know that, you know, he had plenty of people around him, he had armies, and he sort of set up all sorts of things to sort of maintain his power, and, you know, went on to be an extremely important figure. So he's not really lonely, but he keeps talking about how he doesn't have anyone around, he doesn't have any friends. But this is all sort of more indicative of the fact that he doesn't have anyone around him that he can trust. And so we get into this place of, I suppose I called it an illusion of isolation because, you know, he obviously has people around him, so it's an illusion. But it is this sort of sense of emotional isolation. So it transcends the physical, and it's more of like a metaphysical, emotional sense of isolation. And if we talk about the idea of someone having a great deal of power and feeling isolated, that does speak a lot to what's going on in Russia right now. And this idea of this country feeling like it can't trust anyone around it. It has had this history where the only way that power has been able to maintain itself is by not listening to what anyone else is saying, sort of putting up the guards, putting up the walls and saying, listen, it's almost like this taxi driver kind of lone wolf attitude, which is like, I've been let down so many times. I have so many traitors at the gates. I can only listen to myself. I can only form my own cultural identity. So in the lead up to next week's episode, let's sort of tie in everything that we've talked about this week. So to begin with, in talking about Compromat, we talked about this idea that Russian has this cultural identity that it really wants to protect. It wants to defend it tooth and nail. But when we talked about Andrei Rublev, we talked about how hard it is to actually forge such a thing, how hard it has been, not even just for Russia, but how hard it is for a person who wants to be culturally influential, how hard it is to forge, to manifest a clear and coherent and reliable cultural identity, right? So how do people do that? I suppose when we looked at Ivan the Terrible Part 1, we talk about the idea that what you have to do is you've got to have a firm hand of power. But that's nothing unless you can make sure that you're doing that independently, that you can switch everything else off, that you can turn the lights out on everybody else and have sort of guts in doing it yourself. So when we go into next week's episode, I suppose we have to sort of take these values and sort of question, how have they been transformed in the age of modernity? And what can these transformations tell us about Russia today? Well, that's it for this week on Sacred Cinema. I've been your host, Timmy Bernasconi, here on 2XX 98.3 FM. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you again next week for part 2.